The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Orthodox Nationalist. Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson is a former professor of Russian and Ukrainian history and philosophy, an Orthodox priest, and a theorist of nationalism and agrarianism. And now, here's Matt.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another edition of The Orthodox Nationalist. I want to say, first of all, that the generosity of many of my listeners and readers has been quite humbling. And over the last few weeks, I have received some donations, and I can't express my appreciation for the generosity of many people for me in very difficult economic times. All I can say to you is that I promise and I swear that any money that I receive as a donation will go exclusively to my research and or the needs of my chapel and parish, which is dedicated to the protection of the Mother of God. So I thank you all from the bottom of my heart, and as much as I loathe talking about money, and even more so asking for money, it's something that for someone like me is a necessity, because unlike my opponents, I do not have a huge taxpayer-funded university giving me money. I do not have huge old money foundations giving me cash or government contracts or anything else that makes the wheels of our opposition continue to move. I have none of this, and I even go so far to absolutely refuse any tax exemption from the IRS because I am a Russian Orthodox priest and have a parish, and all that goes along with it. I guess I could apply for a tax exemption, but because of the nature of this regime, the nature of the system, and the fact that once you get that tax exemption, you then become completely dependent on the state, and then the state then dictates precisely what you can say and what you can't say. Okay, that having been said, the last maybe 6 months, I've received quite a number of emails asking me the same sort of questions about me personally. And it isn't something that I talk about very much. It's improper and really not appropriate for this kind of format. But the questions have been repetitive. And they've been just over the last 6 months, which I find a bit intriguing. And here are a few of them, and I'll just give you very quick answers and move on. People ask me how I got into, as an Irishman from New Jersey, how did I get into this Russo-Ukrainian Orthodox vision? And the answer to that is very simple. My very concerned with the Bolshevik Revolution, concerned with the idea of the violence of the left. And then when I went out to Nebraska, I was a Senin Fellow of Political Science and Political Philosophy at the University of Nebraska for the period of time it took me to get my PhD. I lived within the Ukrainian community in Lincoln, which numbered at the time maybe 50, 60 people. And they really adopted me as their own. Their kids had left and abandoned the faith and the tradition to become good bourgeois Americans. And then when they saw me showing the greatest amount of respect to them imaginable, they really took me in and showed me a great amount of respect. And they became my second family. And the fact is that, of course, they're in their late 80s now, and there's only a few of them left. My wife and I were married at the Ukrainian Orthodox Church out there, and their mission and their strength. They're Ukrainians from Poland, and so after World War II, they were sent to the Displaced Persons, or DP camp, and this particular group of Ukrainians who wound up in Nebraska were at the Remagen DP camp from, I believe it was something like 45 to 47, and then they immigrated to America. And these are the people who took me under their wing, and from there on in, I focused my work entirely on the rapprochement between Russia and Ukraine. And that's, you know, to me is the ultimate in significance. I do the Western Rite of Orthodoxy as a priest exclusively. My metropolitan trained me when I was in the seminary as a Western Rite priest and that kind of liturgics. I think that the true and proper pre-schism, let's say 1100, liturgy in the West is extraordinary if done properly. And there are only very few people in the world who are doing it properly. Some of the Russians and some of the Antiochians are essentially Anglicans, and they're doing the Anglican Rite, and they're claiming that this is Orthodox, and we have to condemn this in no uncertain terms. When I was in the seminary, I worked under Metropolitan John, Archbishop at the time, Lobue. He is a L-O-B-U-E. He was a Jesuit at one point, a professor of Latin and Greek at Fordham as a Jesuit, and he became Orthodox and, of course, left the order. And because of his abilities, he really was the perfect guy to come and work under as a scholar of the Western Rite and of medieval liturgics and theology, both in the East and in the West. Being an Irishman, getting deep into the old Romano-Celtic Anglo-Orthodox liturgy, to me, was one of the most extraordinary periods of my life. We call it either the Liturgy of St. Gregory or the Liturgy of St. Tikhon. I usually call it the Liturgy of St. Tikhon because it was, you know, the bishop in America, who we've dealt with on this show before, who put his authority behind the building of a true and legitimate Western Rite. And liturgies are not named for saints because these saints sit down and write the liturgy. That's never how it works. Liturgy develops very, very slowly. The liturgies would be a St. Mark, St. Peter, St. John Chrysostom, St. Basil, St. Tikhon, St. Ambrose. They're named for these saints because these saints put their authority behind the promotion of these specific liturgical forms. So I call the Western Rite that I do the Liturgy of St. Tikhon because, number one, you know, Tikhon is Russian and unites the Russian Orthodox Church to the legitimate Western Rite. And number two, that the Liturgy of St. Tikhon, at least to me, is a broader catch-all term that refers to all of the attempts, the scholarly attempts, to resurrect the ancient Western liturgies that the Church of Rome had suppressed and destroyed. One of the worst indictments of the Roman Catholic Church, and one of the reasons I left the Roman Church many years ago, is that in the interests of uniformity, the Pope of Rome destroyed and banned all the older Western liturgies. So we're talking about the Celtic liturgy of Iona. We're talking about the Sarum Rite of England, the York Rite in Northumbria, the Gallican Rite, the Mozarabic Rite, the missals that have surfaced in Northern Europe and Scandinavia. These rituals were suppressed in the interest of papal control and papal centralization. Unity of liturgy was meant to complement the unity of the episcopacy in Rome, and it was a grave sin, and it shows the complete schism and heresy of the Church of Rome. So getting into the Western Rite under Metropolitan John, who was the first man, along with Bishop de Rome, of the Synod Abroad in Manhattan, the first two men to do all the translations of the Northumbrian texts, the liturgies of York that had not been translated ever into English. And so the liturgy that we do is the liturgy of St. Gregory, St. Augustine of Kent, sort of the old Roman liturgy might be another useful name that has not been done in a millennium. And so we do that. And I do it exclusively, but I call it either the Liturgy of St. Tikhon or the Liturgy of St. Gregory, but I use those terms as sort of a catch-all, a very general epithet to describe them. Now, several other questions that I've been getting, especially over the last few weeks, have to do with the various issues and arguments that I have made concerning old Russia, new Russia, and its relationship with Ukraine. This relationship is really the heart and soul, from a secular point of view, of what I do as a professional scholar, trained both as a historian and a philosopher. And the issue is simply this. In this day and age, Orthodox people need to join forces anywhere and everywhere. They must put aside any kind of political differences and begin working together. One of the most attractive elements of the Orthodox life is that church is not centralized. It is a decentralized institution that is based on ethnicity. In other words, the church does not function if it is this foreign imposition done in a foreign language like Greek or Latin. It has to be a part of the day-to-day thinking of the people. And therefore, the Orthodox Church and also the ancient Western Church had as its organizing principle the idea of autocephaly. Autocephaly is a complex philosophical notion. It refers to the idea that the church, its liturgy, its canons, its way of life and thought have to be united to the day-to-day customs of the people. That implies that it must be done in the local languages. It must take into account and sort of baptize things like the cuisine and the political history and the tradition and the mores, family life of the people who adopt it. And therefore, the true church, the Orthodox Church, is organized around synods, for the most part, that are ethnic. Russian, Ukrainian, Finnish, Polish, Greek, even Coptic. These languages are used to very closely integrate the faith and the day-to-day life of the people. One of the great errors of the Roman Church is that wherever they go, from Africa to Asia to Latin America, they, up until the late 60s, imposed the Latin language on everybody. Keep in mind, too, that when I use the word language, I'm not just referring to vocabulary and syntax. I'm referring to the entire way of life of a people. Everything is linguistic in the sense that it's based on every possible and conceivable kind of communication. Verbal, nonverbal, the art and poetry of a people where the common population is able to express itself and to express its deepest beliefs. And when you connect the gospel of Jesus Christ to that way of life, you then make it relevant to the day-to-day life of the population. St. Gregory the Great, Pope of Rome, in the very early Middle Ages, made it clear that pagan ritual and many pagan ideas are not false. They are simply incomplete. They go as far as unaided human reason and experience can possibly go. And many times they are very, very profound. The agrarian life, the blessing of the harvest, these are all very legitimate forms of expression that are natural to mankind. The idea of Gregory the Great, people like Kirill and Methodius, was to use and improve and spiritualize the ancient pagan understanding and sort of rebuild it with its final end in mind. It is no accident that the ancient Orthodox Church, overwhelmingly speaking Greek, used people like Plato and Plotinus and the Stoics like Zeno and Marcus Aurelius, because these were tremendously profound and very, very deep ideas, especially the idea of logos, this universal reason, this universal wisdom that is inherent in how the natural order works and functions and progresses. And therefore, the concept of paganism is a loose one because I don't believe that it's actually a religion. It is simply a metaphysics. It's an ontology. It's an ethics that humanizes the day-to-day connection, the natural order, including our own self, with society and with our will. Paganism is not a religion. You don't have to believe in any of those gods. Those gods are explicitly the creation of poets like Hesiod. And these are poeticized manifestations of our understanding of social forces, also natural forces, motherhood, fatherhood, the military, the sea, different species of animal. These are profound concepts. They certainly are not religious. They are the manifestation of poetry. To be a true religion, in the accurate, more technical, professional sense of the term, there has to be this way of life and thought that connects the individual, the family, and society to God and his interest in what he has created. Without that, you don't have a religion. The word religion makes no sense. Another issue that has come up several times among those who listen and who read my stuff is the question of race. I generally don't deal with the topic. I'm not much of a racist. I know that there's a lot of listeners of mine who are. I never had that racial concept. My mentality has always been religious and ethnic, not so much racial. The big issue is that race as a variable in analysis and social science or philosophy, these are very, very large, very broad categories that I just don't think are useful. I dealt with Lev Gumilev on this show, and I think he probably comes as close to me on these things. Not to mention the simple fact that I am a great admirer of Asian peoples. I think Asians, both from the subcontinent as well as East Asia, are highly intelligent and highly motivated. So that's really the question on the race issue. On the Jewish issue, my approach is completely honest. I grew up in a Jewish area. All my neighbors were Jews when I was a kid in Union County, New Jersey, and I saw the good and the bad of these people. It was at that point growing up that I knew what Purim was, how what they say about us, how they loathe us, and getting involved in reading the Talmud much later on filled in some of the gaps. My concept is that if you're a Jew and you reject the Talmud, then you are a friend of mine. If you accept the Talmud, you are antisocial, because that set of books is filthy. And even if it only represents a certain faction of Jewish thinking, it is so vile and disgusting in how it treats the non-Jews, especially women, is really the fact that the Jews continue to defend this thing says something about their mentality. I just wish that the Jewish mentality was not so liberal, because they support such fanatical inbreeding nationalism in their world, that they insist on cosmopolitanism and liberalism for everything else. That kind of double standard is outrageous. As far as the Holocaust is concerned, I do have a problem with the basic narrative, the way it's developed, especially over the last 30 years. Now, the question is, even if the Holocaust is as bad as your average Jewish nationalist will say, it is still just one genocide of very many in the 20th century. And my problem mostly is this moral concept that Jewish suffering is inherently more serious and more devastating than the suffering of everybody else. So the question isn't so much whether it happened or not. I do believe that the Jews were murdered in large numbers, but that's true of many other peoples as well at the same time. Putting Jewish suffering ahead of everybody else is immoral and simply wrong. Something else I wanted to say today, I wanted to apologize to some of my friends as well as many of my opponents for my temper. It's something that I have had for a long time. I lose my temper very easily and get involved in some very nasty shouting matches as a result of it. There's disagreement that's constructive. There's disagreement that seems to dedicate itself exclusively to name-calling and trying to tear someone down. So I want to apologize for anybody who I've offended in that respect. One very alarming, problematic aspect of political debate these days is that it's hardly possible to to go through a debate, whether verbally or in writing, that doesn't end up with somebody claiming that their opponent is mentally ill. Oh, you're paranoid, you're pathological, you're a hater, you're repressed, this or that. It's very, very common and very, very dangerous. I want to impress on you that especially during the Khrushchev era in the Soviet Union, claiming that your opponent is insane often meant that you got sent off to a camp and pumped up with all kinds of drugs to make you more malleable for the system. So I want to warn my friends and my opponents that this constant claim that your opponents are mentally ill is dangerous and it needs to stop. Okay, we are about midway through. Let's take a break and then we'll finish up this somewhat less formal radio show in a few minutes. Hang in there.
Don't go away because there is more on the Orthodox Nationalist. This is VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. Let's return to the Orthodox Nationalist, hosted by Matt Johnson.
Okay, everyone, welcome back to this latest addition to the Orthodox Nationalist radio show. I'm doing somewhat of an informal presentation tonight because I've been receiving an awful lot of emails asking me questions, and to be honest, these emails are becoming very repetitive. And it's the same questions over and over again. So I figure I'll just take this time and spend the hour answering these things. I don't particularly like talking about myself. I think it's very arrogant. But since these questions are more or less repetitive, I will take them one by one in no particular order. The academic question. 2 days ago, I received an email from a professor. I believe it was Washington State, who asked me what happened. And why is it that I lost my job at Mount St. Mary's University? And the simple question is that it is based on ideology and it is based on my teaching style. And I was told that my teaching style did not conform to the template that academics are supposed to follow when lecturing. And I developed a lecture as almost a poetic presentation. And was very critical of the academic establishment and the bureaucracy. And I know for a fact, I've been on search committees, I've been a professor for a long time in several universities. The fact is that the only real variable that a department, at least in my field, is looking for is your ability to conform. That is the only significant concept to these people. Ability is not the issue. And in fact, if you are too good, as I was, you are a threat and they will remove you. The fact is, my student evaluations at Mount St. Mary's University were the highest in the university. I was told this by several people. The students loved me. The students thought that I was different and interesting and lectured on complicated stuff without notes. And other professors did very little work. They didn't seem to be experts in their field, and they were showing movies, doing PowerPoint, all kinds of silly games and stuff like that. And most of this was to avoid actually lecturing on anything. The fact is that many of my colleagues at the university were extremely poor, non-critical thinkers, and they're there because of their conformity. And to be told, as I was several times, that you're simply too good and therefore you're a threat, really shook me. And I was quite upset by the notion that what any bureaucracy, but especially in academia, what they want is somebody who is generally competent, but not too competent. Because when you have somebody who is very, very good at something, they're tough to control. Now, I know this. I was a musician for a long time. I was a bass player and a drummer, both in rock and in jazz, many years ago. And I learned that the hard way as well. If you're a true musical genius, like a lot of young, I mean, I'm not claiming to be one. I was not a musical genius. I'm just saying that if you are a real creative musical genius, you will have a tough time getting work. That's because a record company and your manager realize that if you are a true genius, you cannot be controlled. You don't walk in to someone like that and tell him how to play. And as a result, competent but mediocre musicians are promoted overwhelmingly. And it's an issue of control. And I was in the same boat relative to my university teaching. And this is not my concoction. This is something that was told to me many, many times. Okay. More substantial scholarly stuff in terms of my particular views on Russia and Ukraine and their interaction. This is the very heart and soul of who I am. As far as Russia is concerned, I have a strong belief that the old ritual, the old believers were correct. That the development of the Petrine state was totalitarian. Peter purged the church. He executed many bishops and monks and priests. And it seems that the average Russian nationalist out there wants to ignore it. In my opinion, Peter the Great was possessed. He was a high-level Mason. That's not controversial. And he brought the Cossacks from Ukraine in large numbers to work on the city that he named for himself, St. Petersburg. And it was an occult ritual. The Cossacks were worked to death and froze in the extreme north. And their bodies dumped into the foundation of the city. So if you know anything about the occult, dark Gnosticism, the concept of building a city or anything else literally upon the bones of your opponents is an ancient pagan occult, almost an alchemical notion. Peter was possessed by demons. Peter was a high-ranking Freemason. Peter, relative to the technology available to him at the time, to the very early 18th century, was as evil and as thorough in his slaughter of his opponents as the Bolsheviks were. Had Peter had access to the technology that the Bolsheviks had, Peter would have been just as bad. And it is an outrageous lapse for a lot of these people to simply ignore Peter. And then Catherine the Great as well also was also eliminated and purged the church. The Russian Orthodox Church was purged many times in the 18th century. And it's one of the reasons that both the Ukrainian autocephalous movement and the old believers were correct, because they both accused the church in Moscow and Petersburg of this kind of demonic altering of the services. And the old belief is certainly a lot more than just the sign of the cross and the Alleluia. There is no aspect of the liturgy in Russia that was not altered and rewritten by Nikon, Alexis, and then later on those working under Peter. So everything had been rewritten, and I should remind my Orthodox friends that Peter also changed the calendar. He made a big deal, and I make a big deal, about the calendar change in the 1920s in Greece. But people forget that Peter also altered the calendar, and he measured years not from the beginning of the world, which had been the older method, but Peter insisted that it be changed to the years after Christ. My opinion is that the Church of Russia and the royal house were profoundly compromised during the reign of Peter. I think there was an attempt under Tsar Nicholas II and Alexander III as well before him to change that. And I think that in a sense they all realized that the old believers were correct. that the liturgical, political, moral, economic changes by Peter were demonic and led to the deaths of hundreds of thousands of Russian traditionalists, and Russia never recovered. My opinion is that the old believer schism has everything to do with the anemic response of Russian nationalists to the Bolshevik threat. And Russian nationalists and royalists need to come to grips with that profound schism that came into Russian society with the reign and the violence and the savagery of Peter the Great. And I think the old believers are correct because they maintained the ancient tradition. They maintained the communal equalitarian idea. All foreign travelers from Britain or from Germany who saw the old believer villages and settlements exclusively over and over again praised them. They were intelligent. They were very moral. They were happy. They were always prosperous. They supported one another. That movement created almost a utopian approach to the world. And there was a point at which the Christian life died in Russia in the 18th century. It simply died. Even people like Ignatiy Bryanchanov and many others say that Christian life for a short period of time in the 18th century was destroyed in Russia. The resurrection came from the work of St. Paisius, Rakovsky, the Hesychast movement from Athos, and the development of the mentality of Optina in Amanyava in western Ukraine, and St. Seraphim of Sarov. And all of these movements were viewed with great suspicion by the authorities. And many of these people were arrested because they believed that hesychasm and eldership and all of this, the mentality that eventually came into its own at Optina, was somehow heretical. And that's how bad and that's how low the true Orthodox Church had fallen in Russia. Another issue that comes up, again, is the so-called Greek old calendars struggle and what my position is on a lot of these things. I came initially, years ago, to the Milan Synod because it was created by a man who I believe is a saint, Auxentius of Athens. And because I was a strong Auxentius loyalist, and he really only has two movements that he founded, A, the Milan Synod, and B, Hachna. So I went with the Milan Synod, partially because they were very interested in the Western Rite, in the Liturgy of St. Tikhon and the Liturgy of St. Gregory. The Milan Synod comes directly from the Greek old calendars movement in Athens under Auxentius, and then in 94 received a tomos of autonomy from Patriarch Vladimir of Kiev, the new martyr and new confessor. You know, the Russians and Greeks need to realize that the Ukrainian autocephalous movement in Kiev is completely canonical. It was created in Poland, which the church in Poland is about 75-80% Ukrainian, through the canonical authority of both Constantinople and Antioch. And Metropolitan Dionysia, who I've dealt with on this show, was consecrated by something like 25 bishops under the authority of St. Peter the Apostle, who founded the See of Antioch in Syria. He then consecrated a whole bunch of people, including Polycarpus, Igor, many of these people who then eventually created Mstislav, Vladimir, Dmitry, patriarchs of Kiev after the Cold War was over, and created this autocephalous Ukrainian church. It is not the dead hand so-called ceremony of 1921. That's completely irrelevant. Those people, like Ivan Theodorovich, were reconsecrated by the Polish line. The issue is that the problem with the divisions in Ukraine is based on one man. And it is, again, it is simply a demonic way to destroy what had been a very healthy movement. And that man was named Andrei Protsky. Andrei was an open and flamboyant homosexual. whose father, when he realized how sick his son was, hung himself from the iconostasis of his church. Because of the concept of Subbuna Pravna, Pratsky's parishes all left him, leaving him completely isolated. It shows, number one, that the church rejected him, number two, that the Holy Spirit rejected him, and number three, the canonical norms is that such a man in that position may not consecrate any bishops or ordain any priests, and yet he did so anyway. There is no validity or grace in those Ukrainian movements that come from Pratsky. The canonical argument is bulletproof, it's airtight. Those who rejected that line and continued to receive the canonical bishops from Poland, and the successors of Dionysia, maintain the grace of the sacraments. And this is Mstislav Vladimir. Vladimir is where my priesthood comes from, and Dmitry. Dmitry Yurema created another Ukrainian group because he feared that Vladimir, whom he loved very much, was under the control of a man who I think is deeply immoral, and that is Patriarch, so-called Patriarch Filaret. But all of that aside, that is the situation with Ukraine, and I'll ask those who argue with me to come to understand and study in great detail these things before you presume to have an opinion on it. And granted, you have to know how to read Ukrainian, and you also have to spend an awful lot of time in figuring out these connections, which can be very, very difficult. Yeah, the question of nationalism, again, comes up a lot. When I use the word nationalism, I'm referring to something very technical. I'm referring to a set of political, moral, philosophical, aesthetic norms that have come into existence because a certain group of people have been forced to hang together through times of suffering. This is the ethnic group. It is unified by language in the broad sense of the term, but becomes more integrated because of what it goes through, colonialism, warfare, genocide, whatever. And just like a family gets closer and closer if they have to come together to fight a certain problem, a sickness or bankruptcy or something like that, the same thing happens to a nation. It is legitimate. It is, I think, unassailable intellectually, and it also has nothing to do with the state. So years ago, I really became very sympathetic to the National Anarchists for this reason. The National Anarchist movement comes from Johann Herder and Kirinsky and Shevchenko. This concept that the language is what unifies a people. They intermarry because their spouse speaks the same language and has the same basic moral norms. And so as the years go on, the ethnic group becomes inbred, not in a pathological sense, but inbred in the sense that they develop their own very specific cultural and even genetic markers. And so I think that's unassailable. When I refer to nationalism, I am not referring to the state. Absolutely not. And that is a central concept. I refer to myself both as an agrarian and as a Christian socialist. A Christian socialist is what others may call a distributivist. The idea that workers, different professions, should have their own union, should have their own organization, that they should control the factories and vote and elect managers that oversee the accounting and everything else, that there is no moral justification for an owner of a factory to make tens of millions of dollars while the actual value added labor comes from others. And while it's very true that some of these men are a very intelligent businessmen and know how to take advantage of gaps in the market, yet that does not justify that these people can become billionaires. That money needs to be put back into the society to rebuild, would be infrastructure or education. And that really the economic vision comes from Hegel, with the idea that different aspects of production are organized into what he calls a corporation. These are specific unions and guilds organized according to the skills that make up a profession, whether it be teachers or policemen or farmers or computer programmers or whatever it is. And Hegel goes so far as to say that these corporations should be represented in the upper house of a parliament. And I'm tremendously sympathetic to that point of view. The agrarian issue is simpler. It's the idea that the human mind and the human psyche are not designed for the lifestyle that modern people lead. When you drive a car, when you commute to work, your brain is forced to move very rapidly. When you're driving a car at 80 miles an hour, your brain has to make 10 times the number of decisions and calculations than it would if you were walking or riding a horse. The simple fact is that modern technological life, despite the benefits that it's given to everybody, and they're quite legitimate, is extremely unnatural. Defenders of modern technology may talk about the internet, the very fact that I could do this radio program the way I'm doing it. They'll talk about eradicating smallpox and stuff like that. And that is quite legitimate. On the other hand, they also need to be honest and take into consideration that the same technological progress that created those legitimate things also created nuclear weapons and created poison gas and created the machine gun and led to these high-tech wars like World War I and World War II, that slaughtered hundreds of millions of people. So science cannot simply say that, well, we've created all of these great things, and therefore you're just a hick who doesn't understand. They also have to deal with the fact that that same technology created the totalitarian state, that created whether it be the Holocaust or the Soviet Gulag or whatever it is. After World War II and the development of nuclear weapons, the fact that the scientific establishment can still be on the offensive rather than the defensive is absolutely outrageous. And they have a lot to answer for. And that is legitimate, taking into account also the good things that it's done over the centuries. So I refer to myself, to kind of put it like this. I am a Russian Orthodox agrarian Christian socialist, specializing in Russian and Ukrainian history and philosophy and the Western liturgy of St. Tikhon and St. Gregory. And I serve under what we call, shorthand, the true Orthodox or Old Calendar Orthodox Church of North and South America, deriving from Tomos of Vladimir, the new confessor and new martyr of Kiev. And from a canonical point of view, from a historical point of view, from a theological point of view, that unity, what I just described to you, is absolutely unchallengeable. Canonical unity there is absolutely perfect, or at least as perfect as these kind of things could ever be. I also want to stress something else. The old medievalist, traditionalist point of view was that the individual as such is an abstraction. There is no such thing as the isolated individual. It does not exist. You have a lot of people who attack nationalism claiming that the ethnic group is just a concoction of elites. But there is nothing more obviously a concoction than the individual. Individuals, it could be me or you, are who we are because of the community that raised us. There is no such thing as individualism because the language that we speak is not our creation. The tradition within which we are raised is not our creation. The educational establishment, for better or for worse, that assisted us in our education and literacy was not our creation. The armed forces and police that protect us is not our creation. The technology and ideas that we live within every single day is not our creation. The world around us, the way we look, all of this stuff, these have come into existence long before we did. So I don't see any legitimate grounds for people to say that I am an individual, I have a right to pursue exactly what I want, and that I am a sovereign individual person. The very fact that this sovereign person, so-called, is born completely helpless as an infant who needs to be taken care of by a family, mother at the absolute minimum, but a larger family structure, social structure, proves that the individual is simply a concoction. It's a creation. It's almost as bad as the international community. I have no idea what the international community is. I mean, at most, it's a handful of economic and journalistic elites who control everything. It's garbage. The concept of an individual makes no historical or philosophical sense. Communities, families, ethnic groups, civilizations, these and these alone are real because they create the individual. They create the family that then nurtures and develops the capacities of the individual. So referring to individual rights is literally nonsense. It doesn't make any sense. Rights, in the sense that I have a right to do X, I have a right to do Y, these are not abstract. They do not adhere to us as individuals, since we are not individuals. They derive, as the Christian socialist movement in Britain, the Guild of St. Matthew, and many other movements, they derive from our function in our society. Our rights, our duties, our obligations, our rewards, our struggles, all of these things, they derive from the position in society that we have come to take as normative for us. So in my case, I am a historian and political scientist. I have a certain level of knowledge in a certain specific area, and within that context, I have the right to be questioned, to have people come to me for information, to write with some authority on these things. I have the obligation to continually work and to be honest and to continually immerse myself in the field. That is the nature of who I am when it comes to social rights. And that could be the case for anything but a politician, a plumber, a policeman. They have this same list of rights and privileges tightly connected with the same bundle of obligations and duties, which often, you know, can be very severe and require quite a bit of work. That is the nature of right. They are not abstract. They are not just this right to freedom of speech. You don't have a right to freedom of speech if you're talking about a topic about which you know nothing. There is a duty of freedom of speech when you are an expert in a field, and therefore you need to educate others in your field. There you have a right to argue and to speak, and your hearers, if they're ignorant about the topic, have the right and the obligation to shut up and listen. And that's the case with anything. And that's a central theoretical concept that lies at the root of nationalism, social nationalism, Christian socialism, this notion of the agrarian communitarian idea. And the fact is that our political world and the economic system that we're forced to live under, these are highly complex, highly technical fields that require many, many, many years to fully master. And even there, after that period of time, you have to be very careful and very tentative with how you approach this stuff. There is simply a mass of information that has to be gone through with great care, usually in some kind of apprenticeship with a real master who knows how to kind of wade through all the nonsense. If you don't know about a field, you have no right to an opinion. You do, however, have the right to ask questions, even pointed ones, seeing if you can make sense out of a certain position that you may not agree with in some sense. So it's not, I know I've said this before, and I had a whole show dedicated to it, but it is something extremely important, partially because this in Plato's Republic, in the very beginning of that, is the very foundation of Plato's definition of justice. Because you essentially, it's minding your own business. So I'm at the end of my hour. This was an informal show, one that comes from listeners. and it comes from this list of questions that I get practically every day. And I figured that if this is really this repetitive thing I'm getting all the time, these are apparently important to people, and therefore I needed to answer them. And I thank you for listening. And just one more time, I ask you, with all humility, to please donate to my my mission here, my research, as well as my church. We are very poor. I mean, my metropolitan, John, lives in poverty. Deliberately lives. You know, he probably doesn't have to, but he does it. He lives in poverty because he believes it's virtuous, and it keeps him from using money to control others and to dominate others. And therefore, he lives in poverty, so he does not have to worry about that. I grew up in my father's funeral home in New Jersey, and he made a lot of money. There's a lot of money in that business, and he was never happy. He's an alcoholic, he's a lifelong smoker, and he was never happy. It was a lot of work. You have to work with the public. My father always used to say that these people are idiots who say, I want to run my own business so I could be my own boss. And he used to laugh at that and say, when you run your own business, especially a small business, everyone is your boss. Your boss is the public, your reputation. You are totally unfree when you run your own business. You know, the system is simply rotten. Anyway, I am done here. I really appreciate you guys listening. Please email me with any questions. A lot of stuff has been going to spam recently. I'm not sure why. And so if I miss you, that may be the cause. Anyway, thank you for listening, and I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. The Orthodox Nationalist returns Thursday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. Time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Tuned in to Radio Ariane.